I'd like to start by thanking Bob and Dana and Samantha and Janae for inviting me here and being such gracious and warm hosts. It's my pleasure to be here to help you. That's why I see why I came. I came here to help you, not to give some talk that makes me feel good about myself. So while I'm talking, although there's a designated time for questions, feel free to interrupt me along the way if there's some issue that you really want me to address at the moment. That's the first time ever OpenOffice has crashed on me. There we go. Okay, so these are the topics I thought I would address today. But if there are others, I'm more than happy to talk about them at the end to whatever extent you'd like me to. My topic's title is talking about patents in other jurisdictions. But like any good old Yank, I don't recognize any other jurisdictions as being important except the United States. We're quite proud of the fact that we're only 5% of the world's population, but we're 50% of the world's economy. So I'm going to talk about what the state of affairs is with software patents in the United States today. And then we're going to talk about the debate, and Chris is right on point about this. There's a lot of debate currently going on in the States about software patents and more globally how the patent system impacts the software and information technology industries. Then we're going to talk about why the system isn't being fixed, and most people agree that there are some fixes that are needed. How these concepts can be applicable to y'all here in South Africa. And then just some thoughts for the future, stepping back at a 30,000-foot level, some other ideas that we might want to step back and think about before getting too deep into each granular topic. Okay, so first of all, this is a graph showing the number of software patents issued in the United States over the last 20-some years. Okay, is there anything on this graph that particularly stands out to anyone? That's not a rhetorical question. I want to see hands. Anything on this graph stand out as curious, unusual?
It looks like the HIV epidemic.
The 0405 drop.
Okay, the 0405 drop. That is a very curious thing. Is there anything else about the graph that people find?
The step change between 97-98 and 0506.
Right, okay. So the 97-98 is the one that I want to focus on. July 23rd, 1998, there were no pure software patents in the United States, basically the state of affairs that you have today. The Patent Office was routinely rejecting applications for pure software because they believed under the law and under current jurisprudence that software patents were not eligible for patent protection. Then in 1998, the Federal Circuit ruled in the State Street case that software per se could be patentable. And in fact, anything could be patentable. This is a case that also dealt with business method patents. So you can see a dramatic increase, although there was a steady slope of increase in the 80s and early 90s, you can see that there was a gigantic jump, relatively speaking, when the decision was made. And why that happened is people had been applying for patents on software during the 90s. And the Patent Office had been rejecting. And so all these pent-up applications were sitting there in Virginia. And then the State Street decision comes out, and the Patent Office realizes, well, we have no basis to reject all these patents anymore for being ineligible subject matter. So now we have to find other reasons to reject them. Well, the number one source that examiners go to reject patents for novelty and non-obvious is other issued patents. Well, since they hadn't issued patents on software, they didn't have a good database of prior art. So then, once they got past the what's called a 101 hurdle, because that's the section of U.S. law which describes which inventions are eligible for patenting. So once the Federal Circuit said software was 101 acceptable, then they got on to 102, which is novelty, and 103, which is obviousness, and they didn't have a good database of prior art to reject applications. So this large jump up there is a result of all these pent-up applications all of a sudden being green-lighted. So they all just got funneled out of the Patent Office. And you can actually see for the first couple years, it's pretty flat after the decision. And the reason that is because applications take 2 to 3 years to issue. So people that had been applying for patents in 96, 97, they issued in 99, 2000. Right? So the increase here, which is more dramatic than this little increase here, is because here, if we were to map applications filed, it would have a similar jump up right about here, at the same time that the number of patents issued jumped up, but that resulting issuance wouldn't be seen for about 2 or 3 years because of the lag in application processing. Okay, so that's why at the initial stages after State Street, some people are saying, this didn't change anything, we had the same world that we always had. Well, that's because they hadn't seen the effects of that decision until the additional, not only increase in issuances, but increase in number of applications. So as I said earlier, right now is where you and the European Union and every other jurisdiction which does not allow patents on software per se is sitting. So you'll usually have two people who make different arguments. Some people will say, well, where you are today already includes software patents. Right? You're already issuing software patents. Yes, they're not on software patents as such, but it's a new machine which is a CPU with a processor, with a monitor, with some software on it that does something new, and because the patent will issue on the new machine, in reality that's a software patent. And that's the world that we had pre-98 in the United States. And then some people will say, well, if you allow software patents per se, that won't cause any difference. Well, the evidence in the United States shows that there's a dramatic difference if you allow software patents per se. Okay, so here's some more objective data. The first question is not too hard because you just saw the numbers on the last slide. If you can divide by 52, you can come with a good guess. So how many software patents are issued every single week? In the United States, patents are issued on Tuesdays. That's the only day of the week the patents are issued, every Tuesday. So how many patents on software issued every Tuesday in the United States? It's more around like 750, right? So that means if you really wanted to be a vigilant actor in the commercial space and respect other people's patents, every Tuesday you would have 750 software patents that you would need to look at and review and make sure you don't infringe. Anyone think that's a little burdensome? Just a tad burdensome. Okay. Anyone want to guess how many patent infringement lawsuits? Now, this is all patents, not just software. But how many patent infringement lawsuits are filed every single week in the United States? You can file lawsuits any day of the week, not just Tuesdays. Anybody want to hazard a guess? 5,000? No, we're not that litigious. 55. The numbers are, in the United States, about 1% of all issued patents get litigated, and only about 10% of litigations actually go to trial. 90% settle before trial. So, anyone want to guess, if you are sued for infringing a software patent in the United States, how much of a bankroll you need to be able to defend yourself?
10 million.
10 million? You guys are a little bit more cynical than I am. It's somewhere between 2 and 4 million. But that data point's about a year old, so it probably has gotten up to like 5, 6, 7 million now. And that's just from one suit for infringing one patent. So even if you never get sued, there's still going to be cost in just worrying about the risk of being sued, right? We don't have any patent defense infringement insurance in the United States. So it's really, you have to either just say, if I get sued one day, I'll just close up shop and go bankrupt, or I'm going to need to save some funds to use to defend myself if that ever does come to pass. The possibility is about 0.1%. Yes. If you can prove that the other side brought the case in bad faith, you can make a motion for attorney's fees, but that's very, very, very rarely, if ever, granted. I think I saw one case recently where they did award the attorney's fees for the defendant, and that's because they proved the plaintiff used a complaint without customizing it for that defendant. But of course, that's going to be subject to appeal. That was just a trial court that had that holding. And so the appellate court is usually more conservative with not granting attorney's fees to the defendants. So for all intents and purposes, no. You cannot get your attorney's fees back for defending yourself. Well, litigation, some of you might say, well, if only 1% of patents are litigated, that's pretty small. That's not a big deal. That's like worrying about being hit by lightning, and that's just a natural part of the world. Well, you would be forgetting about the other way that patents get asserted in the United States, and I would believe elsewhere, and that's through a threat letter, or a letter that invites you to license the patent. Have people heard about these letters? I call them nasty grams, right? Because it's a nasty gram, or a telegram, right? So, anyone want to guess how much it costs to send, if you're a patent holder and you want to threaten someone with your patent, how much does that cost you to send that letter?
$50.
$50? Anyone else want to guess?
$1,000.
Okay, a current first class postage stamp is 39 cents. It was 37 cents last year, so the price has gone up.
Including writing the letter.
The cost of writing the letter is pretty form as well, because people who do this for a living have the form letter, and they build a database with addresses, and they just mail merge it and print it out. So about 39 cents is how much it costs to threaten someone with your patent in the United States. Now, we have this thing called willfulness infringement in the United States. It says if you know of a patent, and you are then later found to have infringed it, the patent holder can say that you did so willfully, with bad faith and malicious intent. And if you're found guilty of willful infringement, you are subject to having the damages which you have to pay being trebled or tripled. Plus, you're also subject to having the plaintiff's attorney's fees awarded against you. Okay, so in normal, everyday infringement, if you're found guilty of infringement, the penalty is actually not that bad, economically speaking. You have to pay either a reasonable royalty or the lost profits. That's pretty sound. And it's based on economic jurisprudence, which says we don't want to reward people more than they were economically harmed, because to do so would create perverse incentives to litigate the issue. So there's this theory that pervades American law, which is put the harmed party back in the position they would have been had you not harmed them. So that's why basic infringement damage is either a reasonable royalty, which is the money they would have been paid had you negotiated a license, or their lost profits, which is the amount of profit you diverted from them by selling your infringing work. So that's an economically somewhat sensible basis. But if you can prove that the other side had notice of your patent, which sending them a threat letter does, then you can make their exposure triple that amount, plus your own attorney's fees. So it's like going from a small slap on the wrist risk to a very large risk. And so this sending of notification letters is always economically the wise decision for patentees to do, because it only costs them 39 cents, and the benefit of that 39 cents is that they now have much more money they could get from you if they ever sued. Well, one way you can defend yourself from this claim of willfulness, and it used to be the only way, but it's one way nowadays, is to go hire a patent attorney, right? And then you tell the patent attorney your problems, and the patent attorney will solve them, right? Because the patent attorney will write you a letter saying, "Dear Mrs. Client, I know that you have become aware of a certain patent, and you're worried about whether or not you're infringing it. I've reviewed the patent, and it is my opinion as an attorney, as a duly deputized and accredited bar-registered attorney in the United States, that you do not infringe that patent." Okay? Well, if you have that letter from an attorney saying you don't infringe the patent, that used to be the only way you could defend against willfulness. Now it's one of the ways, and still the largest way you can defend yourself. So anyone want to hazard a guess how much it costs to get one of those letters from someone like me? $5,500? You're both a scale off. About 40 grand. How am I supposed to put my kids through Harvard? How am I supposed to have my beach house in the Hamptons if you don't pay me 40 grand for this letter? Okay. So every time you get one of these threat letters, the law says you're supposed to go out and hire an attorney to get this letter that says you don't infringe the patent. Now, is that a guarantee that you don't infringe? No. The court could still disagree with the attorneys. But it'll usually cap your exposure back down to that reasonable amount.
Excuse me. Mm-hmm. Does the lawyer have to say that it doesn't infringe? Can he just say that, or does he have to investigate?
No. It has to be, quote unquote, a competent opinion. And in order to be competent, it has to be thoroughly written, specific with respect to each claim of the patent, and it has to be really well thought out. It just can't be a form letter that says you don't infringe. Right. It's not a you can pass go and collect $200 kind of thing. Right. And so some of these opinions do get challenged in court by the patent holder, and the patent holder says that wasn't a competent opinion that they could rely upon.
Natalie, what's your liability as an attorney?
Okay, well, your liability as an attorney, you can always be sued for malpractice. But one of the reasons why this stuff is so expensive is because you will be called to testify as the attorney as a witness in the trial, because the plaintiff is usually going to challenge the competency of the letter, i.e. they're going to challenge your competency as an attorney. And so they're going to get you on the stand, they're going to depose you, and they're going to say, "Aren't you an idiot? Don't you not know what you're talking about?" And all these kind of things. So a lot of attorneys don't like their credibility being challenged, and so that's another reason why they charge more for these kind of letters. But most clients, it's very hard to commit malpractice in the United States. So if, you know, there have been defense attorneys in death penalty cases who literally slept while the prosecution put on their case, and they were not found to have committed malpractice. And the death penalty was upheld against the defendant. So if that's an example of how egregious you can be and still not commit malpractice in the United States, I think it's quite illustrative. Okay, so this is the objective data, so how do we feel about it? Well, the subjective opinion of whether this is good or bad depends greatly on who you ask. Okay, large software companies are generally unhappy. And you might think the opposite, but they generally are unhappy because they are the target of most of the threat letters. Why? Because they have the most money, A, and they've got the most products that could be found to have infringed, right? So if I'm going to get a reasonable royalty rate of lost profits, I sue company A, they only sell 1,000 widgets. Company B sells 1,000,000 widgets. I'm going to get much more money out of company B, right? Because they're selling 1,000,000 widgets, so if a reasonable royalty is $1, that's $1,000,000 versus $1,000. So large software companies generally don't like this. Small software companies generally don't like this. They see it as a huge expense every time they get one of these threat letters. $40,000 to a small software company is not an irrelevant amount of money. It is a noticeable amount of money. And it's not only expensive in money terms, it's expensive in distraction and worry terms. I mean, I can't count on my hand the number of small software clients I've counseled who the first time they get one of these letters, they literally think the doors are going to close tomorrow, they're going to have to fire their staff, they're going to be out of business, they're going to be broke, they're going to lose their wife, their dogs are going to run away. Like, all these horrible things are going to happen. Right? So all that emotional cost is quite valuable and heavy as well. So most software companies are opposed to it. Okay, how do patent attorneys feel about this? I see a very nice, right? You have Borat here?
Calling up their realtors.
Exactly. So, you know, patent attorneys, although they may gripe when their clients force them to gripe, behind the scenes they love this, right? The more commotion, the more risk, right? The more exposure, the more fighting going on, the more demand there is for their services. So keep it going, right? So if you ask patent attorneys in the patent bar, they're fine with it. They don't see any problems. What about patent lawmakers? How do you think the lawmakers, patent office, Congress people, how do you think they feel about this?
They love it.
Yeah, they love it for exactly the same reason as the patent attorneys, right? Because the more the patent system is relevant and valuable to people, or expensive to people, the more important they are to people, right? I mean, the worst thing for a patent lawmaker would be for patent law to be minimized, because then their value as being able to influence that law also gets minimized. So the more impactful the law is, the more valuable their influence is. Now we have what I call non-producing entities, or some people in the press call patent trolls. I think it's pretty obvious they love this as well, right? Because they can send these threat letters, they can get people to license their patents, they can make all this money, and they really have no downside to this system of chaos. What about the non-patent holding public? What do you think my mom thinks? She has no idea what I'm even talking about. I say the word patent and she turns off because most people think patents are irrelevant. Right? So then I have to start saying, well, mom, how much is that drugs that you bought this month? You know, how much is, you know, all these devices that you're buying and all these other things? All that is more expensive and there's less competition because of this system which introduces all this chaos. She still doesn't make the connection, which I think most people still don't. Okay, so let's play some true and false. Okay, so this is some of, I will call rhetoric, that some people use to debate different sides of the patent system. Okay, software patents incentivize innovation. How many people think that's true? No, how many people think it's false? Well, I agree that it's false, and I cite just one of many articles here that say there's really no way you can prove any correlation between software patents and incentivizing development. And in fact, you can find some correlation between applying patents to software and a decrease in the amount of investments made in research and development, because all of that money, or at least some of the money that used to go to R&D, now has to be grabbed and moved into the legal budget. Right, so you can spend it on lawyers doing patent-related law instead of funding engineers and scientists and other people that do research and development. Okay, what about software patents harm small and medium-sized enterprises? Small businesses, medium-sized businesses?
Yeah.
Okay, well this depends, and most people, and my opinion is that they do, but to be academically honest here, I'm going to admit that there is a substantial amount of data of relative credibility on both sides of this debate. If we include in the definition of SMEs non-producing entities or patent trolls, obviously it's great for them, right? So there are some small businesses that are really benefited by the current patent situation in the United States. Okay, what about this one? The United States patent law treats foreigners fairly.
False.
Right. Okay, now, inherently, we would all believe, right, we would inherently, subconsciously think that's true. Right, we would inherently hope, at least, that America would not treat foreigners different than it treats domestic individuals or entities. But once I ask the question and I make you consciously think about it, we are all pragmatic and realist enough to recognize that that, in fact, is not the case. And Kimberly Moore, at the time she wrote her article about xenophobia, which is the fear of outsiders or dislike of outsiders, she was a law professor. She's now a judge on the Federal Circuit Court of Appeals, which is the preeminent patent court in the United States. So she wrote a lengthy article about this effect, about how American companies do much better when they're up against, in her case, Japanese companies, but it applies to any foreigner. There was one case that sticks out of my mind, Fujitsu versus Kodak. Okay, I don't need to tell you a single fact in the case, and you can tell me who won. Right? It doesn't matter what the facts are. Right? Kodak wins that hands down 10 times out of 10. Doesn't matter how strong Fujitsu's patents are. Right? There's no American jury that's going to award money to international companies.
Dan, without being picky, surely the question should be, does the U.S. legal system treat foreigners fairly? Because actually it's the legal system that's being unfair, not the law. Because U.S. patent law used to be very unfair to foreigners, but it was revised.
Well, to me, law is a definition which includes what results do people get from it, not just what words are written in some statute. So I'm more of a legal realist, but I concede that that's a distinction that could probably prove the point. Okay, so most software technologists agree the United States patent system is broken. The large software company, small software company, that's who I include, software technologists. The issue they identify is that there's just simply too many patents being issued that do not meet the burden of being new and unobvious. The U.S. Patent Office issues patents. Okay, I'm going to ask this as a question. What percentage of applications filed in the United States do you think actually end up being issued as patents? Anyone want to hazard a guess?
50%.
50%, I hear. Anyone want to hazard another guess?
90%.
It's 90%. 90% of applications filed in the United States end up issuing into patents. In Europe and other jurisdictions, it's more like 60%. And that's because, as Chris said earlier, there's actually used to be a plaque on the wall at the United States Patent Office. We are the patent issuing office, not the patent rejection office. We treat our customers well. Okay? So they're focused on who's applying for patents. Those are their customers. That's who they care about. They're not focused on these people they never hear from, the people that are impacted by patents. Right? So when you reject a patent, you're just going to make your customer unhappy. And that's the culture, that's the belief, that's the ecology of the patent office that results in this inherent belief that all patents are good and should be issued and there's nothing wrong with them. Software technologists also believe patents are too strong. Yeah, most non-lawyers don't recognize the importance of remedies. Okay, and the remedies is what you get awarded when someone has harmed you. So if I was to say to you that the penalty for infringing a software patent would be one rand, how many people here would be concerned about software patents? Not many, right? Because the remedy is so minuscule, it makes it not worth your time. It's not worth your time to worry about a one rand exposure, right? And consequently speaking, it's not going to be worth someone's time to sue you if the most they could get from you is one rand, because the attorney's fees are going to be more than one rand, right? So the remedies, what happens when you get found guilty for infringement, are just as important as what does it mean to be an infringement or what can qualify as a patent, etc. Plaintiffs' contingency fee attorneys, which I don't think anywhere else in the world has, but slip and fall attorneys, we call them. You know, if you've ever been in the United States, you've seen these ads on TV. Say, have you been harmed in an accident? Call Jones and Block. You know, and these lawyers, they represent you for free. You don't pay anything. They just take 40% of whatever you win. Right? I have a really good friend. He's one of these guys. He's made tons of money suing, you know, stores that leave a little water on the ground, or hospitals, or car companies, whatever. He's made a lot of money suing people for harm. He says, Dan, I don't care how my client was harmed. I really don't care. All I care is about how much injury they suffered. because injury is the factor that determines how much money you can get, right? If they were in a huge car accident and they walked away with just a bruise, you're not going to get anything. If they slipped on a small puddle of water, broke their hip, and are in a wheelchair for the rest of their life, you're going to get millions. Okay, so that just goes to point out that the importance of the remedies, what happens when you infringe a patent, are critical to think about when you talk about these issues of patent policy up front. So most software technologists think the penalty for infringing a software patent is too high. And even if they're not found guilty, the risk of being found guilty someday causes them to either chill their behavior now or divert funds to build a rainy day fund to defend themselves, etc. There are also the litigation abuses, primarily from these non-producing entities. The cost of litigation is so high that patent trolls know if they offer you a license for $200,000, you're going to take that every single time, just like Chris said. The cost of defending yourself in a litigation is so much more than what they're offering you a license at that even if you think the patent is worthless, it's still economically wise to pay them a license fee rather than take it to court. And I ask here, you know, are there more global systematic flaws? One that I argue is existence in the past is that it's been created without a proper understanding and appreciation for all of the interests that it impacts, and particularly the impact that it has on non-patent holding public. Lots of software developers who don't want to apply for patents, who don't have the time or the resources to apply for patents. The patent system wasn't created with those people in mind because the patent system was created assuming, of course, everyone would want to get patents. Of course, everyone needs patents. And so the policies which have been decided upon and implemented are ones that are skewed in favor of those people who prefer patents and think they're good, and against those who have concerns about patents. Okay, so these are some things that some software technologists have said in the past. And some of you may recognize some of these quotes, so don't spoil it. But this is someone in 1991 who said, if people had understood how patents would be granted when most of today's ideas were invented and had taken out patents, the industry would be at a complete standstill. The solution is patenting as much as we can. A future startup with no patents of its own will be forced to pay whatever price the giants choose to impose. That price might be high. Established companies have an interest in excluding future competitors. Okay, anyone have any idea who said this in 1991? Yeah, Bill Gates, you may have heard of him. Okay. How about this? XYZ Corporation in 1994 opposes the patentability of software. This is not appropriate for industries such as software, this being the incentive. Is not appropriate for industries such as software development, which innovations occur rapidly, can be made without a substantial capital investment, and tend to be creative combinations of previously known techniques. Anyone want to guess who said this in 1994? Oracle Corporation. Anyone heard of them? Larry Ellison has, I think, the world's largest yacht. He's the CEO of Oracle. Okay, here's another 1990, and they don't all get more and more quote. Let me make my position on the patentability of software clear. I believe that software per se should not be allowed patent protection. And you can... I like this one. On the other hand, the emergence in recent years of patents on software has hurt my company and the industry. Anyone want to guess? Adobe. These are crazy lunatics. They're against the software patents. Right? Only crazy lunatics are against software patents. Right? Isn't that what we hear all the time? Right? Only communists. Right? We don't know what we're talking about. Okay, so this is the last one. The quiz is over. 2002. Patents have not been a positive force in stimulating innovation at XYZ Corporation. Competition is the motivator and the incentivizer. The time and money we spend on patent filings, prosecution and maintenance, litigation and licensing could be better spent on product development and research leading to more innovation. Cisco Systems. Okay, so if everyone agrees we got ourselves in a right fine mess here, why don't we just fix it? We're somewhat smart people, right? We can make an improvement. Things are broken, we fix them. That's what Americans and other people do, right? Why isn't it going to get fixed? They've been trying to fix the system for over 2 years now. Microsoft ran full-page ads, we need to fix the patent system, etc. It got nowhere. Didn't even get out of committee. In Congress, if you want to introduce a bill, it goes into a specific committee who is jurisdiction over that area of law. And so there is a courts and intellectual property committee. And so the bill goes there, and that committee has to pass it, and then it goes to the floor, and that floor has to pass it. This has to happen in both houses, and then if there's any difference, they have to have a conference committee, and they resolve it, and then the president has to sign it. All of the patent reform bills in 2005, 2006 never even got out of the committee. Okay. And this is why. Number one, most important reason is the world's perhaps most influential lobbyist in D.C., the pharmaceutical industry. Because anything that threatens patents threatens the pharmaceutical industry's bottom line, bread and butter, life and death. And they care. Pharmaceutical industry CEOs will get on the phone, will get on a plane, and will talk to people about these issues, while CEOs of a lot of the largest software companies don't see the issue as being important enough. So at the end of the day, they care more about these issues. They care more about keeping the patent system as is than the other side, the IT software side, cares about fixing it. But there are other sources of friction along the path to a better patent system. And these are the people that benefit from the existence of a large and powerful and impactful patent system. Okay, so how do these thoughts and concepts apply to y'all here in lovely Pretoria? Well, first of all, if you haven't picked up on it already, a very American thing to do is to take a nasty concept and give it a very colorful and polite term. Because, of course, you're not going to reject harmonization. And who here is opposed to harmonization? Right? Harmonization sounds very nice. Right? It sounds, wouldn't you like to be in harmony with me? Doesn't that sound pleasant? We can go have lunch, we can sing songs. Harmonization means forcing down the throat of every other country in the world United States policy on patents. That's what it means. Okay? And they have to use the word harmonization to make it sound better. Right? And to make it sound nice. And to make it sound, anyone who's opposed to it, like me and Chris, communists, idiots, whatever they want to call us, right? Because we're opposed to harmonization, right? And so how specifically do they achieve this harmonization? Well, through TRIPS, as Chris explained, and through these free trade agreements, which again, free trade is another one of these US of A-isms, I guess you could call them. Where they basically say, you want to do business with the United States, you have to adopt all these rules. Like, so they go to Central America, and they go to Australia, and they go to Thailand and other countries throughout the world and say, you want to do trade with the United States, you will agree to these terms. Another way that the U.S. law applies to you is through what I will very politely call obnoxious U.S. law regarding jurisdiction. For non-lawyers, jurisdiction means whether or not a court in the United States has the right to impose a proceeding on you. Right? If I, the general rule is, if you are a citizen of Russia and I'm a citizen of the United States, I can't sue you in a United States court, right? Because you're not in the United States, you're in Russia. Right? If I want to sue you, I got to get on a plane, go to Russia, and sue you there. That's the general theory behind jurisdiction. Well, United States courts say, if you have an interactive website anywhere in the world, it's a website that United States citizens can interact with, then you are subject to jurisdiction in the United States. You are subject to being sued in the United States. You are subject to being found guilty of violating United States law. Doesn't matter if you've ever even seen the United States, listened to Britney Spears, seen a Hollywood movie, it doesn't matter. Right? So what does it mean to have an interactive website? It means if you not only display data, but will receive data from visitors from the United States, your website is interactive. So if you sell anything, if you take registration information, etc., your website is interactive. You just, by that act, conceded to allow United States courts to impose United States law on you. That's why I call it obnoxious. Because if any other country in the world tried to do that to U.S. businesses, believe me, U.S. businesses would be up in arms. Can you imagine Kuwait or Iran having a law that says anyone with an interactive website is subject to Iran law? Can you imagine that? Right? Another way that you need to be concerned about or forced to be worried about U.S. law is if United States markets are in any way part of your business. Either they're a supplier to you or potential customers of yours. Okay? So if you want to interact in any way with U.S. markets, then U.S. software law is something that you have to be concerned about. Even if you don't want that, you still have to be concerned about U.S. law as they get successful in harmonization. Right? Let's say you only want to deal with other African nations, and you're just purely an African business. Well, then you can say, well, screw U.S. law. I'm not going to be worried about it. Well, let's say that Sudan or Chad or DRC or some Kenya decides to accept a free trade agreement with the United States and adopt U.S.-style law. So the viral effect of U.S. law will come towards you even if you don't go towards it.
Question on that point. If you display on your website, in other words, when a website visitor, before you can actually view your site, he has to agree to certain terms and conditions. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you've attempted to get someone to agree to terms and conditions before you allow them to interact with your website. So this is a very fascinating area of law called choice of law, or what law applies. Right. So let's say that they want to sue you in the United States. Well, you would have to first show up to present that defense. Then, assuming you show up to present that defense, which you may not want to do or may not be able to do, then the U.S. court will decide which law to apply to that agreement. And so the U.S. court might find that the U.S. citizen, that the contract wasn't valid. They do this all the time. There's a big case in this area with a bus company in Mexico, took all these Texas tourists and drove them around Mexico. And before they got on, they made them sign these agreements saying, you won't sue us if we get in a crash and you lose your arm. Well, they got in a crash and people lost their arms, and so they sued them in the United States, and the United States said, oh, well, that agreement's invalid. So that's completely void. So although you may be able to get people to waive that, the United States courts may see that as a waiver that was not permissible to make. So it's a risk that's open to them. So just to sum up, stepping back, what are some, if I was in your position, what would I be thinking about as I try to decide what's best to do in South Africa, how can I impact policymakers, etc. These are all American phrases. Has anyone ever heard of any of these? Okay, so keep your eye on the ball means be vigilant in understanding the current state of affairs, right? It means being present, being very aware of everything that's going on. Because, like in the EU, where the people in favor of software patents try to sneak through directives through the back door, they do this in the United States all the time as well. If you're not awake, if you're not watching what's going on, it makes it easier for someone to slide something through that you wouldn't have wanted them to. Keep your eye on the road. This means watch out for potential pitfalls that might be out there. Who could be in the way? I mean, Microsoft has been identified as one potential foe, but the pharmaceutical industry, which a couple people mentioned, should definitely be seen as a very large pothole on your road to ensuring South Africa has a legitimate and sound policy on software patents. You may not have thought that when you first walked in here today. You may not have recognized the pharmaceutical industry as a foe with respect to your objectives on software patents, but they absolutely are. They absolutely are, without a question. Keep your eye on your wallet. I've not met more greedy people in the world than Americans. And whether that's good or bad, we're a capitalist society. Americans will go nonstop, they'll work, they'll ruin their marriages, not have any relationship with their children, all to make more money. So, and Americans fall subject to these Nigerian 419 scams more than anyone else. Right? So Americans are the greediest. Now, I'm saying we're the only greedy people, but we are, comprehensively saying, the greediest people on the planet. Okay, so if there is an opportunity for an enterprising American business to come make a deal with you, keep your eye on your wallet, because they will definitely look for opportunities to take advantage of you economically. It's just ingrained Americana. And I say that with all love, and I'm a patriot. That's what it is. And then finally, keep your eye on the prize. You know, software patents may be the issue. Well, let me first ask, how many people have heard of the keep your eye on the prize phrase? So, the civil rights movement in America was documented through a series of films and documentaries that were shown later in elementary schools. And so that whole series of films about the civil rights movement were called Keep Your Eye on the Prize. And so that's where this phrase comes from. And what it means is, think about more global social issues. How does whether or not we have software patents impact life? Well, if we have software patents, that may make it harder for small businesses to succeed here. If it's harder for small businesses to succeed, it'll be harder for people to become economically empowered. If it's harder for people to become economically empowered, it's less likely they'll be able to provide housing and food and clothing and education and health care for their family and their loved ones and other members of society. So this just says, don't be so focused on your one core issue that you fail to recognize how it plays with the rest of life and society. Because sometimes those arguments can be used to buttress your case, and used to support your arguments, and to show how your one piece of the world is relevant to my mom, or some legislator that you're meeting with, or some judge who could care less about patents per se. Make it relevant to more of life than just software patents per se. Right, so those are my prepared remarks, and I would very much love to respond to questions. Let's give her the microphone. You can hire lawyers in the States. You just have to call them. Okay. Hi.
There's a power switch on the.
Okay. Well, I'll just have to use our listening.
Factors that make you oppose the claim system insolvent.
Okay. So the question was a lot of the arguments I've made in software patents could be equally applicable to other forms of patents, and so am I opposed to just software patents or all patents? And if not all patents, what distinguishes software patents from other types of patents? Okay. So many of the factors, you're absolutely right, could apply to other technology fields. Some of them don't, like the patent troll phenomenon, we don't find in pharmaceuticals, we don't find in other fields, because it's much more difficult for a non-producing entity to get some patent on some chemical, because they have to be a producing entity to who have made that chemical, etc., have labs, and it requires more cost. So the pharmaceutical industry isn't subject to that gaming of the system or that manipulation of the system. The issuance of software patents, the point on the first slide with the graph where there was a dramatic increase after State Street and the failure to have all that prior art backlog, that is a software and business method specific issue, because the Patent Office has been routinely granting patents on other fields of technology, so they've had their own backlog of prior art, whereas they had none in software and business method. They had to run out the next day and hire a bunch of computer scientists and a bunch of MBAs because they didn't have any on staff, because it was their policy not to issue patents on those things. So while a lot of the issues are applicable to all types of patents, some of them are specific to software. Now, am I opposed generally to all patents? I'm generally opposed to government regulation. I'm a libertarian and a quite extreme conservative. I'm very skeptical about government interference with freedoms and human action. To me, the patent system is just one form of government regulation. Right? It's a government saying, right? There's no difference to me between the government granting Microsoft a patent on software and the government opening up the United States Department of Software and saying only that United States Department shall do whatever it is that's covered by that patent. To me, it's the same. So the problems that result in restricting freedom, restraining freedom, preventing competition are equally applicable in those fields. So generally, yes, I'm skeptical about how extreme our patent system has gone in favor of the special interests who benefit from the patent system. Now, I'm also a graduate of Thomas Jefferson's University. Thomas Jefferson was the first examiner of the patent system. And I believe that there can be a sound patent system, a rational patent system that does benefit society. I just think today's patent system is just so far in favor of the special interest patent holders that it's just unilaterally, yes, across the board, out of whack with what is publicly beneficial. Next question.
Yeah, I would like to know what happens in cases where maybe someone is based outside the jurisdiction of the US and then they have an interactive website and infringes somebody's patent. Whether the US court have the ability to enforce the decision if somebody ignores a court order, for instance.
Exactly. So you're not a lawyer, right? No, that is a third year law school issue. So you would do brilliantly at law school. Right? So you win, right, Dan? So you sue, I sue you, right? And I've actually done these cases. You sue someone who's a foreigner. They don't show up, right? They tell you to go take the flying leap off of a building, right? So you get a default judgment against them in the United States, which means the judge gives you the judgment you want. Infringement, damages, injunction. Right now, if you want to enforce that judgment, you do have to go to wherever that person has some money, right? I mean, if I've sued you and I've won a judgment of $10 million, and you're not in the United States, you don't have a bank account in the United States, I'm not going to get the $10 million from you in the United States, right? Because you don't have $10 million in the United States. So I can either wait until the day that you do come to the United States, right? I can get you when you're getting off the plane at JFK, like they do with all the gambling guys nowadays. Or I can come to wherever you live in the world, and through harmonization, I can get a court in that country to enforce the judgment against you, right? So I can come to wherever your home turf is. Now, most courts will at least then give you another opportunity to defend yourself, but some of them don't. Some of them will just simply enforce U.S. judgments to collect assets because of other treaties and agreements that the United States government has with that country. So you and your $10 million are not worth enough for everything else that that country gets from the United States, that the United States isn't going to get from you what they want to give from you. And I don't mean any insult, but Donna taught me the word, I just didn't know how to spell it. Okay, so the next question.
I have a question about this seems like an alliance between the pharmaceutical industry and the basically just the software companies. Why did it just turn the role back to where it was in 1998 and simply exclude software from patentability? What is the interest of the pharmaceutical industry in that?
Okay, so the question is, if people have a problem with software patents, why don't they just get rid of software patents and that wouldn't threaten the pharmaceutical industry? Well, a lot of the software companies, even though they don't like the current patent system, they still want the patents, right? Microsoft still wants software patents. So most of these companies who are upset about the state of affairs will not come out with the plank that they want software patents eliminated. Instead, they'll go after the remedies. Right? So they'll want to make patents weaker, right? Or they'll want to make litigation harder for patent holders. Well, by doing that, that's how they threaten the pharmaceutical company's patents. Because if you make all patents weaker, right, then you're making the pharmaceutical company's patents weaker. So it's because the software companies aren't just tackling this issue at 101 or making just software ineligible. They're trying to get at the issue through remedies and other phases of the law which would have a negative impact on the pharmaceutical patents. It is quite funny though, and a recent case that will be heard at the Supreme Court within the next month or two, AT&T versus Microsoft. AT&T sued Microsoft for patent infringement. Microsoft has defended against it. We have this law that says if you export a component of a patented invention, and then that component somewhere else in the world gets used to make an infringing invention, right? So the infringement is not occurring in the United States. You're just sending part of what will eventually be something that would infringe, and that manufacturing happens somewhere else in the world. We have a law that says that constitutes infringement. Okay? So Microsoft ships its software, and AT&T had a patent on like a system for doing speech recognition. So the software is just a component of that system. Well, they sued them, they found them, and the courts under this law found them guilty of infringement for all these copies, all these computers that were made overseas. Well, they've appealed, Microsoft has appealed this all the way to the Supreme Court. Well, in that case, I submitted an amicus brief with Evan Moglen and Richard Fontana, two other lawyers that I work with, arguing that AT&T is entitled to no remedy because the patent that they're suing on is ineligible subject matter. Because it's a software patent, and software is not patent-eligible subject matter. Because the State Street decision, I may not have mentioned it, was a Court of Appeals decision, which the Supreme Court is above the Court of Appeals. So we argued in our brief that AT&T should lose because the patent that they sued on is not worth it. One other entity filed a brief arguing the same thing. Eli Lilly, pharmaceutical company. Right? They're the most outspoken pro-pharmaceutical patent company in the world. So they filed a brief arguing for exactly what you think the software companies would be arguing for, which is that software shouldn't be patent eligible. Because the pharmaceutical industry says, well, maybe we can get rid of all these threats to our patents by getting software outside of our world. So it's actually the reverse of what you would consciously think would be the natural arguments the sides would be making. I feel disgusted to be arguing the same point as Eli Lilly before the Supreme Court on behalf of Microsoft. But these are the weird combinations of interests that can happen in U.S. litigation.
I think you've dealt with parts of my question already in the last two. But let me just ask you in a bit more explicitly. You've shown that a very small select group of people who happen to be running very large multinational software companies don't like software patents. there's a very large section of society, not a majority of course, but who also don't like software payments for a variety of other reasons. What worries me is that how do we make sure that those two groups don't at some stage end up being allies with each other? How do we make sure that what we're trying to achieve, as you said, the long-term vision remains the vision, as opposed to, you know, an enemy is my friend. And are you seeing any of that starting to happen?
Yeah, well, I think the core solution to that issue is to keep your eye on the ballpoint, which is you just need more resources. You need more manpower, you need more money, you need more people who are interested in this. And that's what conferences like this do. You start to spread information, other people become educated and sensitized, and then they want to participate, and you have this growth of a movement. It's got to be grassroots. And that's how you'll have more manpower to monitor all the threats and all the potential alignments that are occurring, and then you'll have more manpower to make decisions about how best to counteract that threat, how to respond to it, how to deal with it. You know, it's like in the EU directive, how they formulated and they rallied the people to support them, and they got all of that support together, and that's how they were able to team up. I mean, I really don't see any other solution rather than just getting a mass of people who care about it and trying to get enough resources available to you to implement your decisions about how to counteract. It's a tough battle. The odds are not in our favor because we're at a resource disadvantage. But we do have truth and, I believe, correct theory, economically, legally, socially, on our side. So we just have to express those points to people, draw the debate, and then once the debate's begun, winning will be pretty easy after that.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I'm quite curious.
That was your question. Next.
I'm very curious to know what your opinion is on the interplay between software patents and how they might assist small firms in securing venture capital funding.
Okay, so my first job out of law school was representing venture capitalists. And my job was to do diligence on patent portfolios of companies that they were thinking of buying. And one of the most memorable experiences of my life was going to this biotech company, and it's relatively software, but it's the same. And I had their list of patents, and I did my own diligence, and I found out that half of them weren't even in existence anymore because they hadn't paid the necessary fees, and that the other ones had substantial issues regarding validity. So I was very proud. I'm the young, industrious, you know, associate. I'm going to go back. I'm going to save my client all that money because they're not going to invest in this POC piece of company. And I'm going to save the day. I'm going to get promoted and a bonus, and life's going to be great. And I went back to my client, and I said, you know, they really don't have any patent protection whatsoever. My client said, oh, we don't care. We invest in people and ideas. The patents will come later if we need them, but that's not really it, right? And Cisco was another client of mine. I actually know Robert Barr, the guy I quoted quite well. He's a good friend of mine. Same thing. Google, same thing. No venture capitalist invested in Google because they had patents, because they didn't have any patents, right? People invested in Google because they had awesome people, an awesome idea, and they were implementing it very well. And now, are there stupid venture capitalists who will go and say, well, this company has 5 patents, so I'll invest in them. Yes, there are some stupid venture capitalists, and they go out of business. But if you look at the successful venture capitalists, whether or not the company they're investing in currently has patents is really not that large of a factor. That's actually quite a big myth perpetuated by the pro-software patent side that venture capitalists care about this.
That's an absolute question for your opinion, really. If you look at the situation in the US, probably one of the few countries in the world where perhaps the majority of patent filings are actually domestic from other people in the US. Do you think a situation like, for example, in South Africa, we're probably talking about something less than 20% are indigenous patents? decline. If you look at countries like Mozambique, it's zero to less than 1%. Does that change the justification narrative we're looking at? I mean, some of the subtleties of these arguments almost seem irrelevant, given the vastness of inequality.
So we have patents in South Africa so that we can incentivize venture capital investment in California. Right? That's your point. Right? Why are we offering patents here which are being used and benefiting companies outside of our jurisdiction? And when you said that statistic earlier, it really shocked me. It shouldn't shock me. I should expect it. The question that I ask is why? Why is my government issuing patents to businesses from other countries? Well, a lot of countries do it, like Chris was saying, because they charge exorbitant fees. I mean, there are a number of countries that have a significant portion of their income derived from the patent fees they charge people, right? So this is one way that they fleece American corporations, is they sell them these worthless patents that they're never going to use, right? And they get some income from that. And I guess that's somewhat of a benefit. But other than that, I don't know why, and I agree with you. I mean, any American that comes and talks to you today in this reality, you say that to them, and they're in favor of patents, you're like, oh, well, don't worry about that. That'll change. You'll get your own industries, and American companies will make investments, right? Just ask them, well, how would you feel if Chinese applications were 80% of all U.S. patents? And just don't listen to what they say. Look at the reaction on their face, right? Well, let's say 90% or 80% of U.S. applications were from China and India. How would you feel about that? Right? They're going to get a little sick in their stomach. They're not going to take a second helping of meatloaf. Right? Although, when the tables are turned, they'll tell you, oh, it's fine, don't worry about it, you shouldn't be eating. Yeah. So, part of this hypocrisy. Another point I make on the whole harmonization, anytime someone mentions harmonization to you, say, well, most of the world has compulsory licensing, so why doesn't the U.S. harmonize with us on that? You'll stop them in their tracks, right? Because they're not in for harmonization. They're not in for making everything equal. They're in for making everyone American. I agree with you. My red flags, the hair on the back of my neck would really stand up when such a small percentage of my domestic patent filings are by actually domestic entities or inventors. I'd be really upset about that. Is there another question? Oh, okay.
Partly curiosity. So around the relationship between local patents and international trade relations. Because we find that most people are alluding to the fact that you either prejudice yourself or not prejudice yourself when you connect with the country to allow local patents or not allow local patents. So what have you seen going on in terms of countries or jurisdictions coming to this kind of pressure and then saying, well, what should we know about in terms of international trade and international relations that could impact that decision?
Yeah, software patents actually don't get that much attention, relatively speaking. Like when the U.S. Federal Trade Representative goes around the countries, they're usually concerned and driven by the pharmaceutical industry. Software patents, because in America there's not a lot of industry full-fledged public support for software patents, even though the large companies like them and want them, they're not out there like full-fledged defending them like the pharmaceutical industry is. So it actually doesn't arise too much in international negotiations, which may actually be a good thing, because you as a country, I mean, I don't want to say agree to accept pharmaceutical patents, but force them to withdraw software patents, because I don't know if that's a good trade-off for your country. But generally speaking, it's not a hot-button issue that's a deal-breaker. So it's one that you can get the U.S. to accept without a lot of acrimony and complaining. What would I say? I would say rely on the EU and their experience and say, look, the EU, first of all, you guys in the United States, you're not even sure that software patents are a good thing, and there's a lot of evidence that they aren't, even in the most pro-patent country in the world. Okay? And then in the EU, they've thought about this issue more than once, and we've had the Gowers review, and other people come out and say, software patents are not a good thing. So, to us, you guys are kind of on the fence. EU is against them, so we don't see how in any way it would be in our benefit unless you're going to trade that for some other, you know, income that we're going to get. So, that would usually be my response.
I just wanted to make an addition to that, and I think it's been an interesting experience in Geneva between different groups of trade negotiators. And there's a group in Geneva called the Sales Centre, who do a lot of work as does the UN, the Quaker UN office. They do a lot of work with different groups of negotiators. One of the things they've discovered is frequently the reason the trade-off doesn't work, or it doesn't work the way perhaps it should do, is because the negotiators work with very different agendas. So the trade negotiators frequently don't understand about the property issues, and therefore are quite happy to accede to things that people involved in such problems or legal negotiators do not want to accede to. So one of the big problems that the CUDO and the South Centre have been trying to deal with in Geneva, both the World Trade Organization and at the White House, is to ensure that all the negotiators from the team are singing the same song. And the problem is, the USTR in Geneva has, you know, hundreds of people negotiating all the time. Frequently, many developing countries have five negotiators trying to negotiate 20 meetings a day. And so there's always this question of how you actually represent those views. And I think this is part of the problem. There's a technical issue, quite apart from the political issue. This is a technical issue of resources. And one of the things that Secure have been doing is they've been running seminars for trade negotiators explaining why intellectual property is not a real issue of war trade. But well, that has come to this issue. So I think it's a very important point. And it's something that every country, not just like everybody, needs to make sure that their trade negotiators are at least aware of the issue of the economy. Because they'll just put stuff in the pot and let it go as a nice issue. They feel they can make essentially a free trade.
Right, so Chris is right. You need to make your trade representatives aware of these issues and try to ensure that they're knowledgeable and aren't just subject to whatever the U.S. representative says. Or form a group. Like the Central American countries were actually quite successful in defending against the U.S. aggression by all negotiating together. So instead of doing just a bilateral agreement, us and the U.S., try to make those negotiations multilateral. So there's more countries involved in negotiating with the U.S., which increases the resources being dedicated to that negotiation. It increases the likelihood that someone somewhere is going to be knowledgeable about these issues.
Sorry? If I can comment on that. Another thing that happens is that what Nick Pedro is prepared for is something soft. It's a, well, we'll make you import, you know, however many hundred thousand times more oranges. I mean, you know, the administration changes and you suddenly can't export them anymore. And yet you change your law in a way which now people have rights. Very difficult to go back and take away those rights. So I think often trade negotiators don't get that specific point. It's one thing to get a benefit which is really fairly soft. It can be taken away quite easier. And another thing to change your law, because even if you know, decide, well, we made that concession, we want to take it back, it's just tough in terms of your own internal balance.
Any more questions?
Okay, well, if you ever have questions or comments you didn't want to make in the big group, feel free to contact me by email or... I do not use Skype, if anyone's curious about that. Email, regular mail, phone, whatever you'd like to do. It's been a real pleasure, and I look forward to talking to you more. Thanks.